Welcome once again to Building the Game, a documentary podcast. My name is Rob. You probably already knew that because you're already listening to the show, and chances are you've probably listened to us before. And if you haven't listened to us before, welcome. We're so happy to have you. With me, as always, is Jason.
Hey, Rob.
Hey, Jason. We also have some special guests here tonight. We have Brian Brubach. Did I say that right?
Yeah.
Brian Brubach. And we have Ben Rossett.
Hello.
Welcome, guys. Thanks so much for hanging out with us.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Yeah.
How's your Gen Con been?
Good. A little tiring, but, you know, I think everybody's having that.
That's what makes Gen Con so good.
Yeah, right. It's part of it.
Gen Con's been fantastic. It's my first time at Gen Con.
Oh, really?
And I just love walking the halls, you know? I mean, the price of admission is worth just seeing everybody have a good time, and everybody's doing their thing, and everybody's happy, and it's just a great experience.
Yeah, the vendor hall is just so shiny.
the vendor hall is great. I love just walking the hall in between the hall and, you know, whatever, and just seeing everyone's, you know, these guys is a band playing in the corner over here, and you turn around and there's, you know, belly dancers doing their thing, and it's just like, yeah, great, man. Everyone's having
Did
fun.
Did you see the fortune teller?
No.
It was great. When we were leaving the vendor hall today, I saw her. She was sitting up on a counter with, like, spread eagle on the counter.
She has a long dress.
with her skirt was knitted, but it's like spread eagle, like her legs were like 90 degrees apart, and she was putting down tarot cards for a guy between her legs on the counter, and he was like, "Whoa!" it was pretty far out.
And the lady's kind of weird because
she's super
weird.
Met
her before,
yeah. She's super
weird.
She says,
"I don't knowing, but I be thinking." Like, she does this like fake like Eastern European accent.
Yeah,
for some reason, but it's obviously fake.
Yeah.
So
if you can find her tomorrow, you should check her out.
I actually saw her yesterday. That's what I meant to tell you, because she was in Hobocon. So I said I had seen somebody. I couldn't remember who. It was her.
But I digress. Well, so what have you guys seen so far that really got your juices going, Brian?
I've been seeing some of the giant games. I hadn't seen that before because it's my first time at Gen Con. So
yes.
It's
such a novelty,
here.
but. I'm like, man, I want to make a giant version of one of my games.
Yeah.
Some of them look like Catan looks really cool.
It's crazy.
And they
have
a robot game again.
The rolling
robot.
The Legos, yeah.
Do they move on their own?
They do.
Because every time I walk by there, people, no, they're not moving. People are just feeding in their cards to the information.
Okay.
And I'm like trying to wait to see like these robots move.
Yeah.
And I'm always going somewhere and I never get to see them move. I just see people like handing their cards in.
Like, they must be moving. They're always in a different position.
Yeah.
What I've loved about it and has got my juices going is just the way that the city embraces the convention. I mean, every restaurant that you walk into around here has got Gen Con posters up, Gen Con stickers, and, you know, and it's great. It seems
it's
really something that Indianapolis has embraced,
and
I felt very welcomed here in general.
Yeah.
So I think it's been terrific.
It's taken them a little bit of time because I've been coming here for 8 or 9 years now, and so watching, it's cool because back when we first started coming, I mean, they just didn't get it. There were a couple restaurants that would change a couple things and try and get attention. And then I think some of the restaurants were like, wow, we should really be doing this.
Right.
These people are here to spend money.
Right.
So
it's like 30,000 potential customers.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. I think this year, was it Rock Bottom that did their own beer this year? Was it Rock Bottom? Was some brewery?
I don't think it was Rock Bottom. I think it was a different one.
Okay. Well, anyway. Yeah, but I mean, so far it's to make a special brew for Gen Con.
Yeah.
I just went somewhere and they gave out free dice. With everything, I think it was like Scotty's gave out, like, you gotta die.
That's
with
cool.
their restaurant name on it.
Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah, and
they
really are embracing it now.
Yeah.
And it's great because, you know, they don't want Gen Con to move. Because Gen Con used to be in Milwaukee, so before this.
Was that it?
Yeah, it was Milwaukee.
Yeah, Milwaukee, okay.
So before it was in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, but that was a while ago.
Right.
So.
And I think there was something a year or so ago where their contract was almost up with the Indiana Convention Center or so ago. And there was some question if maybe they were going to move to someplace in Illinois. Anyway, they were considering moving.
Right.
And then they had a big, you know, big announcement saying, hey, guess what? Gen Con's going to be in Indianapolis for like the next 6 or 8 years or something.
And the
ICC
redid their convention. The convention center So they blew up the dome that they had, mm-hmm. and they built a new field, the field house, which is
right for the Colts.
Where yeah,
the,
right, yeah. yeah, that used to be the ICC used to be attached to that.
So okay.
they got rid of that, and then they filled that in, like the vendor hall that they exist now.
Right,
didn't
that
exist
used to be
2 years
the dome.
Ago.
Yeah.
Oh wow.
Yeah. 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 So they've added a ton of all that whole back half where it connects to the Crown Plaza. None of that existed two years ago.
Well, it's this is my first Gen Con, and because I had heard a couple years ago, well, you should wait till they build the new awesome convention center and then go to Gen Con. So I'm glad that I, you know, slid in at just the right time.
Yeah, you got in perfect. You'll always have good memories.
That's right. That's right.
3 years ago was when all the construction going on. That was a mess.
Yeah,
that was kind of a crummy year because it was a lot of walking down really long, narrow, dark hallways to get to different stuff that wasn't torn down.
Yeah, and things were in weird places, so you'd be like, where is this? And you're trying to find it was difficult, and but it was worth it, because now it's amazing.
It's great,
Cool.
Yeah, what have you guys been playing?
Well, I've been trying to play as, you know, as many unpublished games as I can, and you guys know John Moeller and the Unpub program that he's got going.
He's Car Trunk.
Car Trunk Entertainment on pub.net, I think it is. So, I've been involved with that program for a little while, about a year now, I think.
Oh, great.
And so I've gotten my games exposed a lot through that program, and I feel like I want to give back. You know?
Right.
So I want to meet as many designers as I can here at the convention and play their games and share my games with them.
Yeah.
Sure.
I think I did play... I played Eminent Domain today, which was my first published game of the con. but I've been doing unpub games mostly since I got here. Yeah.
And any standouts that we should look for in the future?
Of the unpublished games, so yesterday I played City Hall, which is Michael Keller's game.
We talked to Michael the other night.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Michael was on our last episode.
Yeah, excellent.
He was great.
Excellent. Played that yesterday, and it had a bidding mechanic in the game, and it was a pretty simple bidding mechanic, because sometimes it can get a little, you know, convoluted in how the bids work and everything, but this one was pretty simple, and I like that. And so I thought that was neat, and I would definitely give that game another try, another play. Yeah,
excellent. Brian, what about yourself?
I'm in a little bit of a similar boat. I haven't checked out the Unpub area yet, and I'm really excited to go do that and try a bunch of like the other prototypes that people are bringing. I've also, though, I haven't played a lot of published games. I've been demoing my game a lot.
Okay.
Just getting feedback from people and pitching it to publishers and stuff like that. So I played maybe 2 published games, and I went to the Mayfair booth, and I was like, I'm going to try to do this ribbon thing. I've always seen this ribbon thing, and I don't know how I feel about it, because, like, you'll look at a game, and you'll be like, oh, I want to try that game. Oh, I already have that ribbon. You know? Like, and I'm like, oh, who am I? So I played the Catan dice game, which I don't know that I'm a huge fan of, but I got a clay ribbon out of it or something like that. So
all right, clay.
So I'm looking forward to, I think tomorrow I'm gonna like spend a little bit of time in the exhibitor hall and actually like try some of these new games. I keep hearing about like Seasons and all these other games.
Yeah.
I haven't.
Right on. Yeah, no, I know what you mean with the ribbons thing. Every year I come here, I'm like, I'm gonna spend some time at the Mayfair booth this year, and I never do.
Well, I went over there, and I was meeting somebody there, and he was playing a game, and he was finishing up, so I was like, oh, I'll go play a quick game. I played Sheer Panic while he was doing that, and I got a ribbon for that, and then he was like, well, I got 2 woods, so he gave me one of his woods, and then he wanted a clay, so we played that, the Catan dice game, so now I've got a sheep, a wood, and a clay, and it's like,
I might as well finish this.
See, that's the interesting thing to me about that, is because the players are collecting these ribbons, and then they're playing Catan because they're trading 2 sheep for an ore. Like,
oh,
I got
gosh,
2 sheep,
right.
And you got an ore, and I need an ore to complete
well,
my...
It's like...
And then they're playing Catan with the ribbons.
Yeah, it's like the movie where the crack dealer comes up and he's like, first one's free. And as soon as you have a couple ribbons, so I don't know. This might be my only year to do it.
When you get the last ribbon, you then get the Knight of Catan. Is that the...
You want the...
And then you
do you want the whole...
How does that work?
Yeah. I got the pitch, because I was over there and I got a very enthusiastic pitch.
I'm sure you did.
You get the 5 ribbons. Clay isn't in... Oh, brick.
It's okay. Brick, yeah.
I call it Brick. Okay, anyway, so yeah, it's clay in this. So you get those five basic ribbons, and you become a Knight of Catan.
Ooh.
And you can display that if you mm-hmm. choose, so everybody knows.
Yeah.
And that gets you a 50% off coupon, which is not too shabby. I think it excludes their new games, but whatever.
But they have a
huge
awesome.
Thing
yeah.
there.
Yeah.
And some other stuff. There's like a raffle, which I always just ignore because I'm like, I'm not gonna win that. But and some promotional stuff.
They usually do the raffle for the Catan set, the 3D Catan set.
Oh,
which costs like $400. It's amazing.
Those are nice.
You, yeah. If you like Catan, you can't look at it and not want to get it. I was showing my wife, I was like, see, we like this game. And she's like, we're not spending $400 on a wooden game that we already have.
Well, then you should become a Knight of Catan. You get a raffle ticket. And once you're a knight, then you can start collecting the other three ribbons, which are something else, and become a Defender of Catan, which I think just gets you another raffle ticket and some kind of promotion. So, am I like shilling for Mayfair? No, I don't know. It's also a cautionary tale, though.
You made this sound very difficult.
It's a cautionary tale because you just... It's like a slippery slope. Yeah, be careful. Right. Don't go over there unless you're planning to spend some time there.
Here's where you got to reassure the listeners that Mayfair is not sponsoring this.
No,
no,
that's
true.
Yeah.
You know,
this is one of the few things that they're not sponsoring.
Fair enough.
Everything else, though. Everything else.
Didn't you notice that the Mayfair logo on our door before you walked in?
Cool.
When you're done with this, we're going to give you a little thing to hang on your badge.
Great, yeah.
That's a lot. We don't have
no, I, yeah, my friend asked, like, do we have to put these on our badge?
You'll be a podcaster of Catan.
Yeah,
podcaster of Catan.
There you go.
That actually sounds cool.
Yeah. I don't think we'd be able to do that. But, I mean, if we actually had this printed up for next year, podcaster of Catan.
Yeah, they'd probably take them away.
They probably would, yeah.
Or they would just assume we were sponsored by Mayfair. Like,
you could
passing
get a sponsorship.
Out fake Mayfair paraphernalia.
Mayfair swag.
Yeah,
I mean,
did you guys
see the Mayfair play area behind the Mayfair booth? That's
yes.
like the size of this hotel. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Right. Yeah.
And they've got the massive Catan back there. So if you like the giant games, check the Catan one out.
Yeah.
It's pretty sweet.
I do like the giant
You don't have to play it. It's just worth going and looking at it. Because it's like, wow.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
One year we were here, they had the Microsoft Surface. Remember that?
Oh, they had their Geek Chic.
Do they?
Yeah.
And they had Catan on that, and you could play Catan with the Microsoft Surface, which is basically like a huge iPad. It's an iPad the size of a dining room table. It's kind of cool. You roll the dice, you're just like, I roll the dice. And they just roll. Oh, and no, there's physical dice. I forgot you would roll those, and they were blank. But this thing knew what you rolled, and it would project it.
I don't know.
Oh, wow.
It was ridiculous.
Yeah,
it was
pretty cool stuff,
yeah.
That's cool.
So,
does it turn off, and then it is your dining room table? You just... press the off button.
I think they said it had a cover for
right.
it.
Right. The Geek Chic, I don't know if you've seen the Geek Chic booth there.
Yeah.
For the
$12,000 table.
Yeah, I try not to look at that too.
Yeah. But yeah,
it's
a neat thing. And they either have a wooden top that's removable or like a piece of glass with the top of it. But yeah. Yeah, it's a little overpriced if you ask me.
Well, $12,000 for a table.
Yeah.
It seems a little high.
I mean, I do some carpentry and that's...
It's
right.
nice, but
it's
I mean,
nice,
it's not
that nice.
It's not $12,000 nice.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess it is if you have $12,000 that you really don't need to do anything else with.
It's not for us, is the thing.
Right. It's for the guys that own the licenses to Catan.
Exactly.
Right.
I would build like a plywood table in my basement.
Yeah. I think one of the Penny Arcade guys bought a whole dining room table from them. So, you know, they have buckets of money.
They can afford that.
Right. So, hey, one of the things that we like to do on the show every episode is we like to talk about a mechanic that we get excited about, or something that interests us, or maybe it might be a mechanic that we really hate, something that really just drives us crazy. So one thing we want to ask you guys is if you have any specific mechanics that you love that you're always looking for in games, and you like games when they feature that, or, again, vice versa, maybe something that you just wish would go away. I don't know, Brian, maybe if you have anything...
I don't know. I've been fascinated with some of these like hidden information, hidden role type mechanics, even though I'm not especially good at them. And maybe that's why it's it's interesting. Well, just games where somebody's, you know, not necessarily, I mean the typical one is like somebody's a traitor, like the werewolf, the resistance, that kind of stuff.
Oh, okay.
But when that's sort of incorporated into another game, you know, a more of a Euro style game.
Okay.
Interesting.
I can't think of a good example.
Okay.
I don't know.
Would that be like that, like liar's dice kind of thing, where you can see what dice you've rolled, but nobody else can see?
Yeah, that too. That kind of thing. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm working on a hide your dice kind of.
Are you? Okay.
In
okay.
game now that's okay. got that sort of thing. I need to play Liar's Dice and see if I have the yeah. same game.
We've talked about it before. We only know it from Pirates of the Caribbean.
Yeah.
So.
All the rules. We were talking about Liar's Dice. I think we know a lot about them. And I was like, I have to be honest.
Yeah.
The only thing I know about Liar's Dice is how they played it on Pirates of the Caribbean. Because we were arguing about how the rules actually worked for Liar's Dice in one episode.
Yeah, we were.
And which turns out we were both wrong.
So. Right. Okay, that's so secret, like withholding information from the other players.
Yeah, we're like one thing I've been trying to figure out a way to do is like secret movement on the board without having the Scotland Yard fill in the pad kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like some way to represent that in a physical board game.
Yeah.
Where you've got this sort of, I just like that tension of like, what are these other players? If somebody creeping up on me is.
Yeah.
Is somebody like not on the team? Is somebody not
mm-hmm.
doing that? I just like that that sort of tension that's inherent in that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think there are a couple ways you could probably get away with that. I mean, you could have some sort of screen system, right?
Mm-hmm.
That, like kind of blocked. But you could also do it with cards even. Like if you had a board that was made of cards or tiles and you were playing them face down, you might be able to
mm-hmm.
transition your moves like that without people knowing what the cards were,
Yeah, it could be tricky to pull off because you want to make sure it's fair and that everybody is comfortable with the fairness of it and nobody's
right.
cheating.
Yeah, because that is one catch
right.
when you don't know what people are doing. Right, is
yeah.
that they could be cheating.
Yeah, yeah, and that's why you have to you want some kind of physical record of it.
Right,
and be able to reference things on the board without having like too many fiddly components and stuff like that.
Yeah, boy.
So I just got an idea from what you said.
Yeah, all right,
which is great. So secret movement on the board, but being able to track it. So just an idea for like a ghost mechanic or something. So you're at a spot on the board and you have two tokens and one has a little X underneath it and that's your real movement and your other one is your ghost. And so you send them both to different locations, but based on what your strategy is and what players have seen you doing, one of those locations might make more sense. So they might have to guess, okay, is he really going over there to go for that thing? Or is he going over there to go for that thing? So where am I going to send my ghost? Or where am I going to send my guy? Maybe something like that to try to...
Yeah.
So kind of secret location, but it's still physically all players can see what's going on. I have nothing else to offer other than
I toyed with that in one of my games. It was like a sort of like a marathon run kind of game. Like you're under siege and you're sending out, a messenger to, get reinforcements and you just basically have like three guys and only one of them is actually the real guy.
Right.
And so you're moving all of them visibly.
Right.
But
two of them don't matter.
Two of them don't matter.
Yeah.
So you have that tension of like, you can take the guy that's actually got the message and, bluff and like move right next to the other person.
Right.
And like, are they gonna be like, well, that couldn't possibly be, that?
Right.
Yeah.
I'm into that kind of tension.
Those are great ideas.
Really good ideas.
Yeah, I like that idea. All right.
So let's design. All right. So when we're done with this,
okay.
Talk about that.
Cool. And Ben, how about you? What mechanics? What do you like?
I really like deduction mechanics. I guess that would be the name for it. I don't know
sure.
some of these. But I played recently Divinare, Asmodee Games.
Asmodee
Games.
Yeah.
I call it Divinare. Apologies if that's not the right pronunciation of it. But it's like a fortune teller game, and there's these four little stations that you play, and there's 36 cards in the deck, and everybody knows what 36 cards those are. Then 12 of them are dealt out, so there's 24 out of the 36 that are actually going to get played. People keep playing cards, and so you start to gain more and more information.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to, in each one of these four stations, you have a little token. You're trying to guess what the final number of each of these, like, there's going to be end up being three pink cards played, and there's going to be seven yellow cards played, and there's going to be four green cards played. But you're getting a little bit more and more information each time.
Hmm.
But each time you play a card, you have to move one of your tokens. So you can't just sit on the seven space. And so you have to move back and forth. I actually really like it. I think it's really interesting. It's simple. It's easy to pick up.
Yeah.
But you're continually picking up just a little bit more information and then passing a card to the right. So you're getting a little bit more information every time and trying to kind of zero in on what are those numbers in the four different categories.
Cool.
And then there's a scoring at the end of each round. It's a pretty quick game. I think it's 2 to 4 players, maybe. I really like it. So yeah. So that kind of thing has really started to interest
that
me.
That sounds great. I'm going to have to check that out tomorrow.
Yeah.
Because I'm a big nerd for the deduction stuff. I still think Clue is one of the best games ever made, personally, because of that. Because I love that.
Yeah. It's got its high points. It's the deduction being probably the highest point of the game.
Yeah. Well,
it's got some low points.
That concept. I mean, even as a little kid, that was like,
right.
Whoa, you mean it's not just moving my piece around?
Right.
Yeah, that was, as a little kid, that was just mind-boggling to me.
Yeah. Oh, well, I remember I played Clue a lot when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you ask a question, you mark off your little box, right?
Yeah.
And then I played Clue as an adult and was like, oh my gosh, there's like, you know, like, I can tell, like, I can scratch this off too because this happened and, you know, I mean, without even seeing anything, and you're like,
right.
That first time you kind of realized that.
No wonder my older brother always beat me.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's actually, it's funny that you mentioned Divinair, because that was like, it's just, I guess, sort of like a designer sort of sidetrack, but like, you know, that game that you hear about coming out that's got a similar thing to one of the games you're working on.
Yeah.
And then the main game that I'm bringing to pitch at this convention actually has a very similar mechanic in the everybody has a piece of information about how much something is worth kind of thing, or like how many of a certain color are in the thing. And so, like, I heard the, like, little blurb for that game, and I had that, like, moment that you have whenever you use that game.
Oh,
like,
oh, no.
And I had to, like, look it up, and I'm like, all right, you're passing the cards to people. It's like, okay, that's different.
All right.
That's different. Okay, it's different enough. All right, good. And now I just really want to try it, because I'm like, it's different enough that they coexist, but it's the same enough that I'm going to like it, probably.
Right.
So,
right.
It's like going from panic to, cool.
So that sounds interesting. I'd like to play your game, and I'll also just shut up because I keep mentioning things that you are already working on in your game. So I'm totally giving away all your
secrets.
That's what he's got his notepad. He's actually been deducing what you're working on.
This little clue check.
And done. All right.
Like, it was Colonel Mustard in the library with the rope. And
I'm
your
just
game
a,
is about divination. Okay.
Yeah, I'm actually just a liar. I just every time you say stuff, I just say, "Oh yeah, I'm working on that game."
Brian's not even designing any games.
I'm not designing
just a
any
pathological
games.
Liar.
Yeah. Well, Brian, why don't you tell us a little bit more, if you don't mind, about what you're showing here?
It's basically a Gold Rush themed game, and the really basic. I guess spiel of it is like there's different regions on the board. There's six different regions in different colors, and you're staking claims in the different regions, trying to get, you know, claims in the most valuable regions, and the value is determined by sort of like Divinair, these cards that you have that all have a certain color on them, and obviously the region with the most cards of its color is worth more than a region with like zero or only a few cards of its color.
Okay.
And so it's a similar thing. About a third of the deck is not in play.
Okay.
And it's the difference is you're not passing the cards, and the cards all have special actions on them as well. Mm-hmm. And there's some other mechanics, because you're, rather than trying to guess exactly how many there are, you're just trying to guess which ones are valuable. And there's a lot more timing in terms of spending your money and getting income and that sort of thing.
Okay, what's it called?
Working title right now is Fool's Rush.
Fool's Rush. Okay.
It has been noted that there is some. Similarity to the romantic comedy Fool's Rush In. I don't know if I want that association.
Yeah.
You could try and get Matthew Perry on the cover.
Yeah, Matthew Perry.
Yeah.
Sells a lot of board games.
The
Friends.
Actually, Selma Hayek probably would sell more copies, let's be honest.
What? I think the Friends DVD game has probably sold a lot of copies. So
it's true.
That's probably the Matthew Perry factor.
It's a terrible game, by the way. I was forced to play it one time. I was very bad at it.
Yeah? I wouldn't admit that if I were you.
What, that I was bad at it?
No, that you were forced to play it.
Well, it's okay, unless I was forced to play it, and then I, like, won.
That's true. That'd be pretty bad.
Just saying.
So how have the demos been going?
Good. Actually, I've had some interest in some, you know, like, hey, we like this, but it's not really for our company.
Oh, okay.
Overall, though, this has been my first experience bringing a game to a convention and pitching it.
Uh-huh.
And definitely anybody, I guess a lot of people who listen to this podcast are designers or interested in design at some point. I like highly recommend it. Once you get a game that's like polished enough that you're comfortable doing that, just the feedback that I've gotten from publishers, the ones who are interested or the ones who aren't interested, you know, has just been really, really cool.
Yeah.
Like, just, you know, because these are people who have that like laser, you know, vision for like, okay, that works. Okay, I don't know if that works. Mm-hmm. Have you thought of this? Just really, really interesting feedback. I couldn't recommend it enough.
Right on. Yeah, that's really encouraging.
Even if they're not going to publish your game, you're going to get some good feedback on that game, and just on, you'll learn something about yourself as a designer, I think.
Yeah, okay. Cool, that's really encouraging. We, Jason and I actually, the games that we brought with us this time, of course, we're much earlier in our prototype phase than you are with yours, but we did sit down earlier today with a guy, and we probably shouldn't mention his name.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. But we sat down with him, and we each played our games, and I mean, even from the beginning, it was kind of like, yeah, he had a different perspective on it than we did as designers, right from the start.
Yeah, and, yeah.
It was very eye opening.
And he was the first real game designer who we've gotten to play. Like, you know, it's mostly been other people we know who play
our friends and games.
They provide great feedback, but I mean, he was just like spot on, bam, bam, bam with stuff. You know.
Yeah, yeah. Because that's their job is to look at these games and evaluate them.
Right.
And as much as you can think of the business side as a designer and try to keep that in mind, like, yeah, this game has to sell, you're not going to have the same kind of perspective on it that somebody who's actually, like, taking the risk.
Right,
right. Especially being so new at it that we are. Yeah, right.
Right.
Cool.
Yeah.
That's great.
But but I was just going to say, you're right, it was an awesome experience.
It sure was.
To do that. And, you know, we were at a point where we weren't even going to ask any publishers to look.
No, we didn't even
because we have very early prototypes. We're looking for other designers to sit down with, to have him do that, that was
it was a surprise, you know, just having to be chatting with this guy. And he said, oh, by the way, I'm this guy. If you guys want to show me your games, I'd love to see him. So, you know, okay.
Yeah. So he spent about an hour with us going through both games. It was really nice. So.
Yeah, most of the people I've met have been just really nice people and just, everybody's, because everybody wants your game to be great. You know, they might have criticisms of your game, but ultimately it's in their best interest that you become a better designer and have a great game. So it's it's just a really positive atmosphere in general. And most of the publishers have just been really friendly, nice people.
And it helps that so many of the publishers around here are also game designers. So,
you
know, they were where we are once, right? You know, they were there. So now, you know, I think a lot of them want to help people who are here, you know, and they want to sell games too. So, you know, it kind of goes hand in hand.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I think it works both ways. I mean, you're absolutely right. Conventions, for me as a designer, I mean, that's the best use of your time and worth the money and to get wherever you need to be, because you can email publishers for 6 months and you have the opportunity in 1 weekend to meet and talk to more of them than you could ever talk to in 6 months of trying to email people.
Yeah.
But it's the reverse for the publishers as well. I mean, you know, they're here to sell their games if they've got stuff to sell, but they're also here looking for their next game, you know.
Or are they going to be selling a year from now or 2 years from now? Yeah.
And so they get to, I mean, they can sit and take emails from guys they've never heard of or seen for 6 months and not know if the guy is really serious or has anything good. But in the span of 3 days, they could talk to 100 designers and, you know, in 2 minutes, they can get a sense for whether they think that that's something that they want to take a look at.
Yeah.
And they don't have to, you know, so I think it works for everybody being at conventions. Really the way to go for any new designers that are out there. Go to a convention, bring your prototype. Nothing bad can come of it, really.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. So Ben, your big push coming up here is Mars Needs Mechanics, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
It's being published by Nevermore Games.
Okay.
We're gonna be on Kickstarter on August 31st.
August 31st.
So we're getting close. We're getting excited.
Yeah. Cool. Tell us about that.
Mars Needs Mechanics is about winning a spot on a crew on a mission to Mars in 1873. So it's a steampunk game. It's set in Victorian era Britain, and you are competing with the other players to win a spot on the crew as the Royal Astronautical Engineer on the HMS Victoria VII on your way to Mars. So it's
that's very grand already.
Thank you very much. It's an economics and engineering game. It's about 10 minutes to learn and 35 to 45 to play. Kind of a medium weight strategy game with what we hope is a really unique timing mechanism for how we control the prices of goods, of components in the game. So we're really excited about it.
And Kickstarter is launching on the 31st.
August 31st.
Okay, so listeners, this episode's posting, I think, on the 29th. So you should be listening to this shortly thereafter. So The Kickstarter for that will be happening any day now, depending on when you're listening to this. So check it out. Take a look at it.
And it's linked in the show notes.
Yes,
so
it will
get
be linked
there
in the show
to
notes.
It.
Yeah. Cool. That's great. Through Nevermore Games?
Nevermore Games, yeah.
Okay.
They're a publisher in Richmond, Virginia. They're a fairly new publisher. Their first big game is Chicken Caesar. Which should be hitting shelves in about 3 weeks. They've been here demoing it all weekend. They funded it on Kickstarter back in March. That's a real, as Nevermore likes to describe it, it's a real bloody game. It's a political game. It's shifting alliances.
Yeah.
It's making deals and bribing people and then turning around and completely reneging on what you promised them. And so if you can handle that and if you can walk away as friends after the game, it's 3 to 6 players. It's a lot of fun.
Okay.
And so it's shipping right now. It'll be in stores around Labor Day, hopefully, maybe a little bit later.
Sure.
And then Marzine's Mechanics is going to be the next game from Nevermore Games.
Excellent.
Awesome.
That's great.
I like that it's a steampunk game too. That's cool.
We're steampunk fans.
Yeah.
Thank
so.
You very much. Yeah. It's been a lot of fun to do the game and to really get into the steampunk genre as much as we can.
Yeah.
And Brian Fisher, who's doing the art for the game and is also one of the main partners at Nevermore, he's doing all the art for the game. And
oh, that's
it's
great.
Just gorgeous. We've gotten just fantastic feedback on the art.
Cool.
So yeah.
That's cool. Great. Well, I think maybe now we might talk, if you guys are open to this, we might talk a little bit about your processes for game development. I mean, of course, the point of our show here is to be open in our process, right? And we're still new at this, so we don't really have any prescribed process. We're just kind of trying to figure it out as we go along and see what works for us. So we're interested in hearing how you guys come up with your ideas and how you do your own development. If you have any process, or are you just kind of, is every all erratic and you're figuring out as you go along every time? I don't know if you guys have any thoughts on that. Talk some shop here.
Yeah. I mean, I'm definitely like addicted to listening to podcasts where people talk about this kind of stuff. So I talk about the process. I think I'm finding out that my process isn't what I think it is.
Okay.
Because people always talk about the starting with theme, starting with mechanics thing.
Yeah.
And I thought that I was more of a starting with theme kind of guy, because I like theme in a game. I mean, I lean towards like the Euro kind of games, but I always want it to have some, not be like just pushing cubes. I want it to have some theme that I can feel, even if it's like a little thing.
Yeah.
And so I always thought that, and then I started to realize that a lot of the game designs that I'm one of those guys who has like 100 different designs going. I have a lot of trouble focusing unless I have like a deadline, so I'm always bouncing back and forth. A lot of the games that I start based on theme don't really come to fruition. But what happens is I start working on mechanics around that theme, and then one of those mechanics gets spun off into another game.
Okay, sure.
And it's taken me a while to realize that that's how my process actually works.
Okay. Right on. So you seem to kind of start with one idea that bleeds into something else that maybe will take you somewhere.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay, very branching kind of. But it sounds kind of freeform too.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah
just wherever it takes you.
Yeah, like the one I'm pitching now started as I had a horse racing game that turned out to be very similar to the, I guess, Winner's Circle, I think is the one. I hadn't played it, and I was testing this horse racing game. It was like, people were like, oh, this is just like this other game. I like it. Well, yeah, of course you like it, because it's that other game. But it was like that with cards, and I was like, well, maybe I'll just sort of change it. And I was trying to come up with new betting mechanics, and then I eventually gave up on that game and was like, yeah, but I like this betting mechanic. I came up for it. So I started building another game around that, and then that got themed. And
right on.
You know.
Cool. Ben, what about you?
I've had that experience as well. I like to say I'm a mechanics guy, although about half my games have started with theme, I guess, and the other half with mechanics. But I very much have had that experience as well. And actually, Marzine's Mechanics came from that. And so I was wanning to build an economics game, And
sorry, my beer. Didn't mean to.
Wanting to build an economics game, and the central mechanic, which is a timing mechanism in Mars Needs Mechanics, for again how we control the prices of components. That was a smaller part of a larger game. And the larger game was okay, but that was really the interesting thing. That was really the interesting part
sure.
of it. So I said, all right, I'm going to take this and strip away everything else and just rebuild a game around this. And that's what Mars Needs Mechanics became, and that's how it got to that. So I've had that experience as well in process. And I'm the kind of guy where I get an idea. I go home, I write out a page of rules. I throw together some components, you know, whatever, Microsoft Office, just real basic stuff.
Yeah.
I print it out and I play it. So I don't go through like multiple iterations of the rules and, you know, discussing and will this work and that. I write something down, really simple, couple sentences, try to print it out, play it, what worked, what didn't, go back from there. So I like to get a prototype to the table as soon as I possibly can. And see if there's something interesting there.
Yeah.
And I think we both felt like that helped.
We did, yeah. Oh, it helped a lot.
But I can super identify with you, Brian, how I... Because I mean, you would probably agree with this. I'm very thematic in my... I mean, like, that is... Mm-hmm. Like, I think of a theme and I'm like, I'm making a game about this! But it always seems to come back to, there's always one mechanic that I'm like, I'm really proud of this mechanic in this,
mm-hmm.
in this game idea, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so trying to find a way sometimes to say, maybe this isn't the best game, but this mechanic is something you could ship off to something else and
mm-hmm.
try and, you know, because there's absolutely no reason to limit yourself to say, no, this mechanic must go with this theme, because, you know, if that were the case, there would be a lot less games
right.
or a lot
That's
more games
true.
About the exact same thing.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and I mean, in my experience is, you know, you're like working on this game that you thought of because of a theme, and that's sort of motivating you, you know, that theme is exciting you. Because, I don't know, I get more excited about the theme, and then, I mean, I geek out a little bit about mechanics, but the bringing the theme to life is what excites me.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, you're doing that, and you're coming up with these mechanics, and then you hit on that, like, really clean, really solid mechanic, like you're saying, you know, and you decide to pluck that out. And then you have this little, like, game that's, like, this very pure, simple
mm-hmm.
game built around that one mechanic. And then what I found is, then you come up, you know, and then you have this game, and it's, like, almost too simple. And in to build on that, you come up with a new theme and then say, okay, now what could I add to this that would fit into this theme
mm-hmm.
to come up with new mechanics mm-hmm. to enrich that a little bit if it's not a game that can just, if you haven't just come up with like no thanks or something that can just work on its own
right.
with just
right.
the tiny mechanic.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Is that, I mean, is that kind of what, did
yeah,
you have that experience? Did you come up with a theme and then add based on the theme or?
Yes. You know, some of my games have, yeah, I have definitely been like that. I have one that's definitely really strongly theme driven called Stranded, which is about going on a, you know, going out into the wilderness and basically getting stranded, getting stuck with no supplies and having to take care of yourself for about
mm-hmm.
4 days until rescuers come to reach you. And that was, I mean, I went camping with my buddies one weekend, you know, and we went for a long hike and we were like, you know, we didn't bring any of our gear. All of our gear was way back at the campsite. We're like, what would happen if we got stuck out here? We don't
yeah.
have any supply, you know, the supplies
right.
was available,
yep.
about a day's worth of food, that's it.
Yeah.
And so that was very theme driven. And that theme has, like, I've really built the mechanics of the game around that theme. But that is the exception to the rule for me. It's been much more fluid, like you were discussing, Brian,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, a mechanic's really interesting, and so, okay, I think, you know, a theme will work for this, and then, okay, so to fit that theme, you know, kind of put this in a little bit and add this mechanic to it. Someone gave me some really good advice when I was first starting out, and they said, no matter what your theme is, once you get it to the point where you think the mechanics work with the theme and you think it's a good game, strip all the theme out of it, play it as a complete abstract game. Don't think about the theme at all.
Hmm.
Reprint all the components,
yeah.
completely abstract. Play the game. Do the mechanics of the game still work?
Yeah.
Because when you do that, then you can start to see, well, did I really add this mechanic into the game just to fit the theme? And without the theme, it doesn't make any sense at all that I'm doing this. And so if that's true, maybe it doesn't really belong in the game. And so maybe you can find a different way to, you know, to work the theme back in without forcing one of the mechanics. And so I thought that was really, really good advice and something that I try to pass along to designers as well.
That is, wow, I'm terrified of that. Yeah, I was just trying to think of like the game, like for instance, mine is a great example of how the heck would you do that?
Yeah.
The current game I'm doing is a Western game, and I can't imagine like if you could take the whole theme out, how that I would do that. Which
would it still be fun?
Right. So so that's a good point. It's, you know, and it sounds terrifying, and that's good because it should, you know, I mean, that's
right. And the point is not to make it an abstract game. The point is to open your eyes from a different angle and make sure that you're not, you know, that you're not
well, I guess
you're not ignoring problems in order to service your theme.
You're not settling
only
on mechanics
or creating
because
new problems.
You want the theme to be
right.
Okay.
Right.
Because
that's really interesting.
A game could be an awesome, I mean, we've all played games that had, you look at the game, you look at the artwork, and you think, oh, this sounds so cool, and then it's terrible.
Yeah.
And you bought it, right, which is good for the designer, but you bought it or you played it because it looked cool, and the theme looked awesome, you know, and the mechanics could just be terrible. I mean, we've had that experience a lot of times, demo games. Even recently, even today.
So, boy, that sounds like a neat idea. Oh, it's actually not very fun at all.
Yeah, so...
we won't name names.
Yeah. but yeah, I think that's a really good tip.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's great advice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, so I'm thinking that now. So how could I, with Damsels in Distress, the game that I'm kind of putting my effort into right now, how could I... If I redid that game just with numbers, just strict numbers, would it even be interesting at all? I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah, and I think that's great advice, but I think there are some like minor exceptions to that in the sense that I mean the theme obviously is providing a certain very tangible emotional effect.
Of course.
That is its own thing. And I think some games, that's a big part of it. Because, you know, it might not be completely mechanically sound, but you might get more enjoyment out of the feeling that you're doing this.
Right.
Even if you're not winning, if you feel like you've done this. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I'm not familiar with your damsel in distress game, but, you know, like, if you feel like you're... Are you rescuing a damsel in distress?
Yeah, that's the idea.
Yeah. If you feel... The feeling of feeling like you're doing that is huge.
Yeah.
You know, like, that's... And you're not going to get that if you feel like I rescued a red pawn.
Yeah, that's true.
From the
when we talked about
gray
the two,
square
when we first played your prototype, which was literally just cardstock, handwritten
Sharpie
on
white cardstock,
and then you printed like a real version of the game. I mean, just on his home printer, but you know, and it was the same game with almost no changes. And I said, this is way more fun. And part of the reason it was way more fun is because I was playing with cards, and there was a theme that I could see. And
I mean, even chess, which is like the most coldly mathematical, logic, you know, based game you could think of, it's still, you're having a battle with medieval warriors,
well,
you know?
I think that a lot of that is tied back to kind of the human psyche, right? Of trying to, because if chess is, first of all, it's easier to remember because, well, you know, there's the knight and there's the pawn and there's the bishop
and
the queen.
But you
can
easily have that as, you know, that's figure A, that's figure B, that's figure C, you
know.
And
no one would play that game.
Well, yeah, because there'd be no theme to it, right?
Right.
Yeah. So, but it would still be playable and all
the
mathematicians would still love it.
Right. Which is why in the end, theme is super important. But I mean, to your point, if the mechanics aren't sound,
the
theme's not going to do you any favors.
Right.
Other than
you're
make
not
people
gonna...
upset when they get your game and find out that the mechanics are terrible, but the theme is really cool.
Right.
Well, it depends what people are looking for. Like, especially if you're talking about like a kid's game. Like when I played chess when I was a kid, I loved the knights because they moved funny and it was a horse.
Yeah.
Like, so, you know, one, it was a horse. That's cool.
Yeah.
And, and it, because it moved funny, you know, you could sometimes like surprise somebody and sneak up on them. Even if I didn't win a game of chess, that I could like sneak up and get somebody with my knight was like, you know.
Gotcha with my horse.
Yeah,
I know what you mean. I'm thinking of a game that we looked at. I didn't have a chance to play it, so I don't want to comment on its quality. But I was looking at called Fealty, and we was at the Games Loop booth. I didn't have a chance to demo it today, but the idea of it is that that all the players are I guess the children of the king or something like that, or vassals in his kingdom. I don't, you know. Mm-hmm. Anyway, and the king has just passed away, and so now you're all fighting to dominate the land, to gain the most control of the area, so that when everything settles down, you can be the new king. You can take over. You can conquer everybody. And so that theme I thought was a really, really interesting theme. But then when I picked up the box and looked at it, the artwork just made it look very kind of cold. Mm-hmm. And kind of mechanical.
Yeah, and I haven't played it, but I think it is more of an abstract type game. I don't want to say that I haven't played it, but
right, yeah,
that's the impression that I got. It looked interesting though.
It looked interesting, but it looked like almost a pure strategy experience. Mm-hmm. Yeah, which turned me off a little bit, to be completely honest. I mean, if I'm playing a game, because I've said this on the show before, if I'm going to play a game, I'm usually sitting with my wife, listening to records, and drinking a bottle of wine. And we just kind of want to hang out and have a fun, relaxed time. We're not real hardcore strategy gamers like mm-hmm. that. And, I mean, so it would translate then that the games that I'm thinking about in my head that I want to create are not heavy strategy games. You know, they're lighter stuff.
Well, we've talked, too, a lot about... I mean, yeah. We talk a lot about approachability. And, you know, when you see a game and you look at the artwork and you look at the theme of the game, that can really determine its approachability mm-hmm. To your average. Like, the game group I play with, they would love Sentinels of the Multiverse if I could just get them to play it, but they're not going to play it because it's superheroes, and that's silly. So, yeah. You know, they'll play Settlers because, oh yeah, you're on an island and you're building stuff. That makes total sense, you know? Mm-hmm.
that makes total sense. Right. Like, well, of course you're on an island. Why wouldn't you be?
because you're settling an island. I mean, that's been done, man. Yeah. Look at history. I'm sure. Just saying. Uh-huh. So you know, that it's too bad because it could be a great game, and, you know, I mean, immediately by looking at the box, you feel like, it's not.
I feel like maybe it's not for me.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So I guess what we're talking about is balance.
Yeah.
In the end.
I guess I have a similar sort of effect with fantasy themed games, you mm-hmm. know, which is a really popular theme.
Yeah.
And I don't have anything against the fantasy theme at all. I'm not one of those, you know, you talk about approachability, some people are like, no, wizards, no thanks.
Yeah.
I don't have anything against it, but I'm also not like into it.
Mm-hmm.
And so whenever somebody brings a game, I always have like a little bit of a hesitation because it's a theme that is so popular as a theme, there's a lot of games that if you stripped away the theme, there's not a game there.
Right.
Yeah. And then there's some that if you stripped away the theme, there's a huge game there.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. But it's like, it's always like a crapshoot. Like, ooh, is this going to be...
Yeah. Yeah, you know, we had the experience of Small World. We demoed it 2 years in a row at Gen Con, and we just got a terrible demo. Everybody was, oh yeah, Small World was great, Small World was great, oh, it's so great. And 2 years in a row at Gen Con, we had a terrible, terrible demo of that on the floor. And I was already a little wary, because fantasy, you know, and I mean, I like fantasy, but I'm a little burned out on it, you know? And 2 years in a row, oh, it's terrible, it's, yeah, you know, it just was dumb. It looked dumb, it looked way too complicated, and not fun at all. And then finally, I kept hearing from so many people how great it was. I was like, all right, well, I'll just buy it. You know, I think I found a good price on it at the local game shop. So I just bought it, took it home, loved it. I mean, it's it has replaced Risk for me.
Oh,
you know? Yeah, it's great.
Mm-hmm.
No, that was the one I had when I was thinking of, like,
yeah,
fantasy games that have really strong mechanics. That's what I had in mind. And I had a similar, I had a feeling, because I knew about Vinci, the original, or is it Winky, or whatever, the original game that it was. I think it was the same designer.
Was it really? Okay.
But it was like ancient civilizations.
Oh.
And that's a theme that I am kind of into. So I was like, and that was out of print. And then there was a small one. And I was like, you know, okay. So I'll give that one a try. And
yeah.
And yeah, the mechanics really hold up in that one.
Yeah, they really do. Yeah. Yeah. I had the same problem with zombie games. So I mean, I'm so burned out on zombies. But I know I need to get over that because there's still a ton of good games out there that use that theme. But it's a barrier for me that I have a hard time getting past.
I like zombie games.
I know you do.
I'm a fan of zombies.
Yeah.
In fact, the first game I pitched on our show was a zombie game.
Yeah,
so.
Right. And we've, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's... I would just echo again for any designers that are out there thinking about, you know, I'm not really... You know, I hear this a lot. I've thought about designing games, but I'm not really a game designer. Great, you have an idea, write it down, now you're a game designer.
Yeah.
That's it. That's really all that it takes.
Sure.
And at, you know, and come to a convention and talk to a publisher, and now you're a game designer. I mean, so, and everyone in the industry is just so approachable, especially at these cons, and meet people and talk and hang out and game with them. And you might not even know, you might be in a conversation with two people and, hey, one of them's Zeb from Z-Man Games, and you had no idea who you were sitting there talking to, and he's, you know, you're just playing a game with him at a convention, and
well,
so
that's what happened to us today.
It
wasn't the guy from Z-Man Games, but I mean, that's what happened to us. We're playing with a guy, we're talking to him, and he goes, "Oh yeah, I made this game, and I blah blah blah." And we're like, "Oh wow!"
Hey,
and he's like, "Come show me your games."
Right. You played a game with a guy from Blizzard the other day.
Yeah, two guys.
Two guys from Blizzard. You know, they worked on WoW.
So yeah,
it's like, oh wow, that's neat,
and I beat them too.
Yeah.
Smash them.
You're absolutely right. I mean, it doesn't cost you anything to try to think about it, to play with it. I mean, you were saying you guys write it all up in Word, you know, and all you need is some paper and a Sharpie to draw stuff out if you don't even want to use your computer.
Yeah.
It doesn't cost you anything to think about it and try it.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, I would definitely echo that. Like, if you're, you know, if you've always thought like, oh hey, it'd be fun to design a game, but I don't know, just like print out some stuff, write some, you know, take an afternoon. It's a pretty cheap hobby.
Yeah, it's true.
You know, if you got some paper and pen and just try it. Just try to get that first idea into some like kind of playable prototype that looks terrible and just try it. And then another thing that I would add it as advice, if you are already designing games, you've already done that, and you've got a game that's starting to work, make a nice prototype. Because that's something I learned with my most recent game. I took it farther than I ever had before in terms of making a nice prototype.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not talking about, like, you know, like they say, don't hire artists, don't do anything like that, but just to the best of your ability,
mm-hmm.
you know, make some, you know, try to print out something in color,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to, you know, I had some that, you know, crayons on it. Try not to have crayon in it. because then you can just walk into a, you know, a game store where people are playing and lay it on the table. And if it looks enough like a real game, like put a score track around the outside. Doesn't need it. Just put a score track around the outside.
Sure.
People are like, oh, that's a real game. I want to play that. And you get so much more playtesting and feedback done when you just take the effort to make that like version, which I procrastinated on a while, and now I'm like sold on that.
That makes Jason and I feel really good, because we, you know, we were kind of tearing ourselves off about this. Oh, we're going to go to Gen Con, we're going to go in a month. It's Superior POD. You know, I don't know if you guys are familiar with it.
Superior Print on Demand.
So
basically, you can get a 108 card deck shipped to your house in like 4 days.
Okay.
For $20.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, and it's nice printing. So,
okay.
I mean,
They do like one off or small short run
right.
stuff of game components and stuff. So we each ended up ordering a deck of cards from them, and we were, you know, should we do it? Is it worth putting all this time into right before Gen Con to get it in time? You know,
mm-hmm.
so we want to have some. If we're gonna sit down and play it for people, we want something to look good, is what we're thinking.
Mm-hmm.
But we're also, is it really worth putting all the energy and stuff into? And some people again, we won't name names. Some people said that was kind of a dumb thing for us to do. We should have been focusing our energies on more development, but.
Mm-hmm.
But we took the gamble and felt like, yeah, I guess I really, if I'm going to show it to somebody, I don't want it to be embarrassing.
Well,
sure. And I want somebody,
I want them to take it seriously, to be like, I drew this with crayon. Like, you know, I mean, right?
Yeah.
They look and they say, oh, this guy really wants to get this game published, you
right.
know? And then when you present it to them, just like we did today, we said, hey, mm-hmm. this is pretty early stage in our design process. A lot of stuff is up in the air, but this is what we're thinking.
Yeah.
This is how it's going to look.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, when you're showing it to a publisher, they want to know that, you know, did you spend a lot of time on the mechanics? Did you spend a lot of time developing it? And,
mm-hmm.
and you know, if it's not a great looking prototype, they're
not too worried about that.
But like I would say, like, if you're going to average game group, you probably don't want to print out a deck of cards. But if you're going to Gen Con, you're going to be in the open gaming hall.
Mm-hmm.
Doing that, all of a sudden you have a game that you can just sit out on the table and people will walk by and you can say, hey, you want to play this?
Yep.
Yeah.
And they'll sit down and play it, and you get so much feedback.
Yeah.
And you'll get more of those people that aren't like game designers. Because game designers are great to like critique your game and look at it, but there's something that you won't get from them that you can get from somebody that's a very casual gamer.
Mm-hmm.
It's just watching them play.
Yeah. Excellent. That about wraps us up. Like we said, this show's going to go up in a couple weeks. So where can our listeners find you guys in the future?
They can find me. This is Ben Rossett. You can find me on Twitter at Benjamin Rossett, Rosset. You can follow Nevermore Games or find Nevermore Games on Twitter. Nevermoregames.com is their email address or their website. And for any information about Marcin's Mechanics, which again, one more plug, August 31st, Kickstarter for Marcin's Mechanics. But find me on Twitter, connect with me, I'd be happy to meet, happy to talk, and yeah, I'd love to hear from designers.
Great. And Brian?
You cannot find me yet on Twitter.
Okay.
But I think I'm going to, like, so that's something I've gotten this weekend, like, everybody's got a Twitter, so I'm like, yeah, I got to get one of those Twitters.
That's how I met Ben, via Twitter, you know, I mean, it's...
Right,
you know,
so game designers get on Twitter.
So you'll find me soon on Twitter. Maybe, I'll send you guys an update,
let,
like,
this let is us my know, Twitter. We'll get you in the show notes.
Yeah, we'll link in the show notes. Yeah. So
I'm also working on a website, which you can't find me yet, but eventually you'll find me on a website, so I don't know, I don't have a... I'm Spoonful on Board Game Geek, if you want to send, you know...
Cool.
I'm getting pretty active in the design forums there, which I think is a great resource. So
yep, we've heard
Spoonful
that.
Spoonful and Gorgon. I tend to steal titles from old blue songs whenever I have to come up with a username or something.
Oh, okay, all right.
So, but yeah, when you get more of that information too, just pass it along and we'll get it out to our listeners via the show notes and also via Twitter and stuff too. So
yeah,
great. Thanks so much, guys, both of you. We really appreciate hanging out with us and talking with us. We hope that you have a good rest of the con. Got 2 days left. So thank you very much.
Thank you guys very much. I appreciate you guys doing this and taking the time. And thanks for inviting me. I had a good time. Thank you very much.
It's our pleasure.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for having me on and for doing this podcast. It's sort of like, you know, transparent game design. I mean, I'm addicted to this kind of stuff.
And if you get published, if you get picked up, you know, let us know. We'd love to have you back on and talk about
Come
about
back,
some
plug,
other stuff.
Yeah.
And again, same thing with you, Ben. You know, if you have another project in the future, let us know. We want to make sure we stay in touch.
Fantastic. Thanks very much, guys.
All right, thank you. Thank you, listeners, for listening to Building the Game. Once again, you can find us. Our Twitter is @podcastbtg. Our website is buildingthegamepodcast.com. Our email address is buildingthegamepodcast@gmail.com. Did I get that right?
You did.
I did, okay.
For once,
the first time. What am I forgetting?
You can find myself. This is Jason on Twitter at @JASlingerland. And Rob?
I'm @poorly_designed. And that takes care of us.
That does.
So thank you, everybody, for joining us. And check back next week, and we're going to have more awesomeness.
See
later
you next
on.
Week.
Building the Game is a co-production of Imminent Entertainment and Poorly Designed Studios.
All the ideas presented by Rob and Jason are the property of the Building the Game podcast.
Next time on Building the Game.
Frank, do you want to say something else for the microphone?